Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast, the show in which we chat about the movies we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. And who's the we in which I'm referring to?
Who's the we?
We's me. We is me and...
And we.
Joining me as ever. It's the old leaky bucket boy, Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello. All right there. How's it going?
Yep. On today's episode, we are doing the 2015 survival Oscar flick, The Revenant, directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Yeah.
Starring Leonardo DiCaprio and featuring Tom Hardy, Domhnall Gleeson and William Poulter. It is adapted. It's actually not adapted. Hang on, what does the book say? Let me grab the book. This is the book that the young men everywhere got for Christmases when the film came out. And I will say about the imprint of the book that they released to cash in on the movie. It doesn't have a big old picture of Leonardo DiCaprio on.
That's surprising. Okay.
Well, I don't think it is surprising because a survival film about a man in the wilderness. If I'm reading this on the tube or the train...
They don't want people to see the picture of Leonardo DiCaprio on the front cover.
Yeah, that sends the wrong message. That sends the message, I love Leonardo DiCaprio. No.
That sends the message that you're a wet indoors boy instead of like a dry outdoorsman.
And yeah? it's very classy blue hued book. And it says at the top in very oversized text, it says the book that inspired the movie.
Okay. So it's just inspired by, because the film poster says inspired by true events.
Yes. And by all accounts, Michael Punk, who wrote the book that inspired the film, he was also inspired by real world events, which basically are about a guy called Hugh Glass, played by Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie. He got attacked by a bear in the wilderness and got left for dead by his compadres. The film takes that, and Punke took that. And
when did that happen? When was the real story?
Oh, back in
that occurred
back in these pioneering days, 18.
Oh, back in today.
The book, which is set in 1823. We opened in 1823, so that's when your trappings and your trappers are all out there in the Alaskan wilderness.
We're talking 201 years ago.
So the book cover is kind of classy. It's also not classy in that it's kind of, it's also obviously it's saying, oh, you know, this is from a film. I tried reading it.
Any good?
It's rubbish.
Right.
No. Eyes fixed on the two wolves, Glass set his torch to the sage. There had been no rain for weeks. The brush was dry as tinder and caught fire easily. In an instant, flames rose 2 feet above the sage next to the carcass. Glass lit 2 other clumps. Soon the carcass lay in the middle of 3 burning bushes. Like Moses, Glass planted himself with his knees on the carcass, waving the remnants of his torch. Lightning struck and thunder boomed. That's what they do, man. Lightning strikes and thunder booms.
Thunder cracks sometimes, though.
Wind whipped the flames around the brush. Rain fell
now.
Wind
does whip.
Though not yet enough to douse the sage. So it's fairly decent prose, but...
It didn't blow your socks off.
It didn't make me want to carry on reading it.
Hello, it's me, Joe Devine, from the Movies You Forgot podcast. Little editor's note here. And I'm doing this on behest of Adam, who's left me an editing note to say, add this, speech marks, Joe here, ellipsis, Adam really dropped the ball setting up this episode and waffled on, and it all had to be cut. That's actually true what he says there. We did have to cut a lot. And I'm to let you know now that at this moment in the episode, we pick up discussing the infamous bear attack scene where Leo DiCaprio gets well and truly mauled by a bear, end quote. That's it. That was my editor's note job. So now please enjoy us discussing how unpleasant the bear scene is.
I'd forgot how unpleasant that is to watch.
It's really unpleasant.
Really unpleasant.
In particular, the pause and the not calm but the kind of eye of the storm calm halfway through where the bear has stopped attacking him. And the whole time you go, oh, it's fucking coming back, isn't it? This is the bit you never think about in your fantasy of being attacked by an animal. You think about it attacking you, it all happening, and then it going, and then it's over, right? And there's this wonderful thing that happens in The Revenant where the bear attacks. It's absolutely horrific. Leonardo DiCaprio isn't dead, and he's lifeless and still, and so the bear leaves him alone, but is still kind of haunting around the edges of the shot. And Leo starts to wriggle, and you go, oh, God. The bear's bloody coming back, isn't it? The bear's coming back.
I think it's too much. And I think the film is just really pleased with itself at the extent to it shows. I had to watch The Grey because I needed something to wash away this overly... I haven't even said how fucking long this film is. I haven't even done the Letterboxd. Let's pause. It's 157 min long.
Yes.
Okay.
That's quite long.
It's unacceptably long. This is a revenge film. This is a wilderness survival film. To a lesser extent, it's a mano film. This is a shameless grab for Oscar attention. And this is the Letterboxd. Noun, one who has returned as if from the dead. In the 1820s, a frontiersman, Hugh Jazz, sets out on the path of vengeance against those who left him for dead after a bear mauling.
Yeah.
Now that's not what the film's about.
That's sort of what the film's about.
And it's not. The people who left him for dead, it's the person who left him for dead.
Yeah.
And not just that, killed his son.
Sure, it is missing that bit.
There's no Native American son in the book. That was added by the filmmakers.
Presumably to make Leonardo DiCaprio a more a more likable character. Because you watch that as a kind of modern, embarrassed progressive. And you think, oh, he has a Native American First Nations son. Therefore, he's the good character.
Right.
And Tom Hardy's the bad one. Because there's not loads that's super likable about Hugh Jazz.
You don't have to make him likable. He gets attacked by a bear. But they've already given him a dead wife. They've already dead wifed him. It's just that it's so Hollywood.
Would you have preferred the film if he didn't have a dead wife or a son that was murdered and that he was just abandoned after a bear attack and he thought, hey, fuck those guys, I'm going to get them?
Yeah, that film would be amazing. I would love to see that film because there's an hour where he...
Oh, man, I can't wait. I wish I could visit the alternate universe where that is the film and you still hate it.
I watched The Grey. The Grey is about a bunch of...
wolves.
Yeah, but they get these blokes, Liam Neeson et al. They're in a plane. It crashes. And then they have to survive in the wilderness.
Against the wolves.
Liam Neeson has to... they give him a dead wife to like him. And he's also been... He basically wants to kill himself. Fighting the wolves gives him a reason to live. There's a wolf attack. There's a horrible wolf attack. It's far more effective than the bear attack in The Revenant because it doesn't show as much. It's not so horrible to watch. But it just keeps it lean and mean. And it's about men versus nature.
Can I tell you my favourite moment of that film, though?
What, The Grey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My favourite moment of The Grey is when Liam Neeson calls the main wolf and says, I'm going to find you. I'm going to kill you. And I'm going to wear your fur to a Christmas party.
No, I mean, try at least nail the accent. The Grey is not a good film, but it's so watchable in comparison to The Revenant because The Grey knows what it is. The Grey is a film, a survival film. This film, it dares to be about, it's a revenge film. How dare it be this long? Self-important?
No.
How dare it be? No. Wait, how dare it be this Hollywood? And also, oh, we care about Native Americans and we want to represent these different stories. It's so phony. It's so hacky. It's so in love with its craft. Look at these long shots. Look at these long shots. We've practiced these for ages. Grow up. Make a film that isn't this long. It's offensive. It's offensively long. I hated this film.
I can hear that. I can. I'm going to offer a my.
There's a whole sub. There's a whole other thing that I have to talk about. But no, it's definitely your.
There's
go.
More. We've been going for 20 minutes.
I was ill when I watched book. This.
You were ill. Yeah. No. I mean, I think you might be ill now. Listen. Okay.
Come on. I'll listen. It's my turn to listen.
I text you. Yeah. When I watched this film beforehand, I sent you a picture of my TV with the opening credits on it. And I said, I really don't want to watch it. I'm not in the mood. It's been on my TV for about an hour and I've been procrastinating. Anyway, that's how I felt. How you feel now is kind of a bit how I felt before I started the film. And then I watched the film and I quite enjoyed it. And now I feel good about the film.
I was ill when I started watching this last week. I've been ill longer than I've been ill ever. It's been a long, long week. And I watched, this was at the beginning of my long battle and journey through illness.
What did you get?
Just obviously just being really, like, horrible headache, really tired.
You got the sort of the flu.
Listen, let's not point fingers.
No, I'm not denigrating it. All points and fingers, I'm asking.
I don't recognise the flu as something. That's just a catch-all, okay?
Right.
I got laid low. Okay, I got laid low big time. I don't get ill. And when I do get ill, it really knocks me. Okay.
It scares you.
It knocked me big time.
This is a bad film to watch ill.
No, this is the beginning. So I'm not even at the full peak ill, but I've had a day off work. My family left me. Okay, I was at home alone.
So there are some parallels.
I was home alone. My wife was effectively dead, and I'd lost my children. Okay?
Yeah, they left you.
Sorry.
They left you.
They'd left me, okay?
And you were on the couch.
They'd left me for dead.
You were attacked by the bear of the salted peanuts.
I'd been...
Your blood sugar was spiking.
I'd been attacked by a bear, and yeah... And I'd been left alone to die.
Yeah.
Now I'm laid low, and I'm watching a movie about who gets attacked by a guy who gets attacked by a bear.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, I barely have the will to live, and I've got the flu. What is this guy? How is this possible? This guy? How is this? I'm not consciously thinking that, but subconsciously I'm rejecting this experience that someone is going through, because I'm what I'm dealing with,
because you're having a bad time,
is pretty low level, and I'm struggling to I'm just struggling to keep my spirits
up. Just be
in
it, man.
Yeah, I'm supposed to believe that this guy can have his fucking back torn off by a bear.
Yeah.
And then can, like, what?
And then can still... Well, that's part... It speaks to the incredible journey of Hugh Jass and played very well by the wonderful Leonardo DiCaprio, who I have to say, Adam, I just fall more and more in love with as we do this podcast. Not this specific episode, all of the times we've talked about him, I just love the guy more and more.
This is him at his most self-important... And
no,
it is, he insists on having a Native American son, and he insists on barely having any dialogue. He's got his fingers all over this fucking script. It's pathetic. It's so craven, his need to get an Oscar. I'm such a hard man. I don't speak. The only time I'm interested in him in this film is about an hour and a half in, when he finally starts surviving, when he catches some fish and he's frozen, and it's like, oh, this is what I want to see. I want to see a survival film. Are you a big fan of kind of survival horror?
Do I like survival horror?
Because I talked about The Grey. There's lots of films like this.
Yeah.
Are you
the other ones?
You're a big fan of them?
I don't think I love survival things. I like post-apocalyptic survival stories.
Yeah, like The Road. You love The Road.
I love The Road. I quite enjoyed The Book of Eli. Do you remember that? The big D Washington movie?
Yeah, never finished it to completion.
No. I mean, that was quite fun. But beyond that, I don't really like them. What about Mad Max? Would you consider that a survival movie?
No.
No. It's kind of a chase movie.
That's a chase movie set in the desert.
Speaking of Mad Max, though, I do want to talk to you about Thomas Hardy, because he's a sort of, he's kind of an odd fish to me. I don't really, you know, I think when this film came out, The Revenant, Tom Hardy was a sort of peak level fame, a super mega A-lister star. And also he had this for a while. He had this kind of this aura around him that not only was he a terrific movie star, but he was also a very serious actor, and he seemed quite intense and took things very seriously. Since then, though, probably since about 2015, I'm kind of uncertain what I think about him. And sometimes I watch films where I think he's terrific. Other times, I think he's almost kind of pantomimey. This, and I'm not sure where The Revenant sits within that, but I'm curious, what do you think about Tom Hardy and about his career?
Well, it's amazing. You are very much a savant in that you've answered the question in your own question.
I'm good at that, yeah.
You've nailed the problem embedded in your observation about Hardy.
And it's a Hardy problem.
It's not. It's a really dreary problem. He used to be a very exciting, interesting actor.
Mm.
And then he became a movie star.
Yeah.
And that is what happened.
When did that happen, though?
I would say Inception is when everyone...
2010.
Everyone went, what?
Yeah.
He's magic in that movie. And then subsequent to that, when he's Bane,
yeah,
that's the seal of approval.
Well, because here's the run, right? Like, he has all of his normal movies, and then he does Bronson in 2008.
Bronson's the film that establishes him as an actor.
Obviously, prior to that, he was in Band of Brothers. He had a slightly bigger role in Layer Cake. So, you know, folks might have recognised him already by that point.
I'd seen him in Rock and Roller, which is a rubbish film. He's fantastic in it, and I think that's when he's popping. He's in that, and finally he's in some good stuff.
There's not really anything he does between Bronson and Inception, which is 2008 to 2010, and then immediately after that, the hits start to kind of fly, don't they? So between 2010, which is Inception, we then have Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, we have Warrior, we have Lawless, we have The Dark Knight Rises, and eventually in 2015, we have Mad Max Fury Road, The Revenant being the same year. So like that five-year period is kind of huge for Hardy.
And he's not the star of any of those films.
What about Warrior? Which, if folks haven't seen, is like a UFC film. With him and what's his name?
Joel Edgerton.
Joel Edgerton, yeah.
Joel Edgerton is as much, that's a buddy brother film.
It's a good film.
It is really good.
Lays it on thick.
He's small in Tinker Tailor. He's obviously, he's Bane in Dark Knight. He was very much fronting up Lawless. So he's big enough for that, but that was quite a small film, didn't do that much. And he's fronting up Locke.
But Locke is just that seems like a kind of interesting art project. That seems like Tom Hardy, the actor, wants to take that on, right? As opposed to Tom Hardy, the movie star.
Yeah, and he's the star of The Drop.
Yeah, yeah.
But these are all, they're all kind of smallish indie. He gives some heft, but he's not Leonardo DiCaprio. The big one is Legend, when he plays both
Reggie Cray and Ron Cray.
And that's where you start to realise this is when the actor and the star are collapsing in on themselves, and he's disappearing up his own arse, and he's forgotten how to be an actor. He's very talented, obviously more than me.
Yeah, I mean, Legend came out 2015, the same year as The Revenant. That's the first one that I watched him in, and I thought, this is a terrible film, and this film isn't at all saved from being terrible by the central performer. It's the kind of movie where you might see an Oscar nomination for the lead performer, and then no other nominations for anything else to do with the film. Right? I don't like to be very mean, but that's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pantomime. You compare that performance to Bronson, and it's baffling. That film and that performance, so much of that has got to be down to old Nick Winding, because you compare it to something very, very similar where Hardy gets to, you can do both Crays, play one straight and go crazy with the other. And he's all at sea. It's appalling. It's a really, really duff piece of shit film. And everything after that, he's really bland in Mad Max. I don't think he was supposed to be the original. I don't think he was the original Mad Max. I can't remember who it was. But he doesn't really turn up in that movie.
I really love that film, and I think he's exactly what the film needs. I would agree with you that he probably isn't the star of the film, but I think he gives the performance that the movie requires of him.
For who he built himself up to be, this kind of edgy, exciting, vibrant Bronson, he's a nothing in that film. He doesn't.
But that's kind of what the character needs, isn't it?
No, he doesn't. I disagree. Like, have you seen the original?
No, I haven't seen the Mel Gibson ones, no.
So shut your mouth then. I think it looks like someone who's scared with what he's scared. He's scared.
Man, you see a lot of stuff, don't you, when you look at things? Often see things that with such a creative imagination you have.
I just think it's a big spectacle and he doesn't know. He's all at sea. If you watch him in Venom, the two Venom films, they're rubbish. He's trying to be funny. He doesn't know what to do.
No, he doesn't. All right, here's my theory about Tom Hardy.
Here we go.
Okay?
Here we go.
Tom Hardy, I suspect, is like the kind of actor that shows up, gives this incredible performance in Bronson. Everybody watches it and thinks, wow, this guy, he really went all out for that part. And he's kind of kooky and wild and scary. And he's not afraid to be expressive and physical. And he's like an old school actor and a modern actor all in one go. And it's he's perfect in this film. I can't wait to see him in a normal film. Yeah. And then he shows up in the next film and there's a bang straight out of the park. Another huge, great big performance. And yet it's another film that requires that kind of performance, yeah. And then after the sort of third or fourth time, you go, oh, that's just who the guy is. That's not the performance. That's just who he is. And maybe the theory concludes that maybe he just picked excellent films to be in early on, and Chris Nolan took a shining to him. Otherwise, his career might have worked out differently, maybe, because that with that trajectory, with that peak, and that rise, that crescendo that Tom Hardy goes on between 2008 and 2015, I'm expecting to see him maintain that top tier status. And the reality is, actually, it's been 10 years since he made a good film. You know, all I would say in retort, and it's not even a retort, but I feel compelled to share my perspective after you so graciously did yourself.
This is what the show is.
Yeah. Okay. I expect that the people who made the film The Revenant do not recognize their experience.
Sorry.
In what you are saying. Okay? That would be my expectation. I think from having read and watched interviews about the challenges of the filmmaking, that it would have been difficult, but probably groups of people within that cast and crew would have had to have pulled together, so it were, over different periods of time there in order to achieve something. So this description of that you have of a film as a group of people coming together to make something, I think there are probably few examples that of films that are set in conditions that require that collaboration so much as The Revenant. When I watched Leo DiCaprio in this film, I thought, bless his cotton socks, look how hard he's tried. Give him the bloody Oscar. Well done. You know, this is horrible. This is unpleasant. And also, when you're Leonardo DiCaprio...
This is horrible. This is unpleasant. I shouldn't have to watch this.
I enjoyed watching it, right? And I think I put myself in the shoes of Leonardo DiCaprio. First thing I do, look in the mirror, take off my clothes, have a quick look down at the old, the old toolbox, and I see what I'm working with. Check out the firmness of my body. Yeah?
Yeah,
this is the first thing I would do in almost anyone's body, is just have feel of the firmness of my body. But anyway, after I'd done that and looked around the house and stuff, my own personal episode of Cribs. Do you know what I'm saying? After I'd done all of that stuff, that all any normal person would do if they were Leonardo DiCaprio, what I would do is I would think, what motivates me? What drives me as Leo DiCapricorn?
Ego.
What is the
ego?
Ego. Well, sure, but we're all driven by by ego.
Absolutely, and his is the biggest.
Listen.
Listen. It feeds itself. It's a monster. And it continues, it perpetuates itself. And you need to have a certain kind of personality to be a star like him or Tom Cruise.
And to keep coming back.
You hate Tom Cruise.
Keep getting back up on that horse.
No, wait, look, I don't mind.
I don't hate Tom Cruise.
No, look,
just uninterested in him as an actor.
Great. What I'm saying is, I can't believe you've swallowed
Listen, you interrupted
his
me. I didn't even get to finish what I was saying.
I know, I did.
Drives me as Leo DiCapricorn?
You were talking about staring at your dick. Okay, that's why I interrupted you. Sorry.
Challenge. It's who am I? I'm a god. I'm Leo. Yeah, I'm a god. What can I do that can be? How do I want to feel like a human being? Yeah, I'm not getting that in my personal life. Because I can have anyone that I want, yeah? I can't have real friends because I'm Leo DiCapricorn. You can't have them unless you made them 50 years ago, right? What can I have that makes me, that is a human challenge for me? All I can do is pursue more art and films, yeah? And what sounds like a hard thing to do? Oh, this thing in the fucking wilderness, that sounds like an experience that I haven't had before, that sounds like an experience that I can't buy with all the money that I have. I think perfectly innocently about it. And I'm sure that there are more cynical realities that are swept up in that, a big medley of different motivations. But I think the idea that you could remove any innocent or uncynical motivations, you know, the idea that the only reason that he would want to make that film is so that he can win an Oscar is dumb, is what I'm saying.
I agree. I tossed that off.
You stay off my man.
This film really turns. I was big into Leo as much as you were. Go back. You listen to Revolutionary Road, my friend.
Yeah, you love Leo.
Catch Me If You Can.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's brilliant.
He's so embarrassing. He makes that film.
Yeah,
he's got a lovely sort of stutter speech impediment that he brings to that character. I don't know, was that on the page, Quentin? Who knows? But Leonardo really brings it to life. But in this, I see a scared little boy who just wants to present a version of himself. And it's all about protecting an image, and it's not about a role. He doesn't want to bring anything to life. He wants to present an image, and that's what movie stars want to do, and that immediately just shut me off. This film leaves me so cold. There's no emotion anywhere near it, and this is about my wife's died. Oh, Tom Hardy kills my kid. This is about the rape of the land. I'm dead. This film leaves me dead inside. This film makes me feel nothing but boredom. And it's all because of him and his big face and presenting himself to be like, this is the image I want to present myself as. This is the kind of character I want to be. And it is the most alienating, anti-art thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And I'm not overstating.
No. I don't know, really. I'm a natural glutton for lots of things. A glutton for punishment, I suppose, being one of them. Amazing to me that I've been doing this job for over 20 years now.
What is it with Leo and dead wives?
Has he got many of them?
There's loads in his movies. It's like, let's just talk about dead wives.
When's he got them?
He's got Shutter Island.
Shutter Island? That's a dead
Shutter
wife?
Shutter Island, mate.
Hold on, I'll read a film to you. You tell me whether he's got a dead wife. Romeo and Juliet. Technically, yes.
Not really, but she will be dead.
Titanic. No, he's the dead one. Mm. The Beach. No dead wife. Okay, where's the dead wife? Does he have a dead wife in The Aviator? Does Howard Hughes have a dead wife?
No, he's got a mummy thing in that.
Revolutionary Road, there's a dead wife at the end.
Yep.
Shutter Island, dead wife.
Dead wife.
Inception, dead wife.
Dead wife.
Did J. Edgar have a dead wife?
Didn't watch it. Dead, that would have been mummy as well.
Mummy's dead in Django Unchained. Not, I don't think wife.
He's not the main star of that, so that doesn't
count. Okay, so it has to be main star. Wolf of Wall Street wife is most certainly not dead.
Yeah, that doesn't fall within the dead wife theory.
No. And The Revenant, he does have a dead wife. And in Killers of the Flower Moon, his wife does die.
And
it's not far off. I would say it's a 40% strike rate for dead wife.
Yeah.
But either dead already or dying during the film.
And factoring into how he acts.
Absolutely.
You know, Liam Neeson in The Grey, I hate to bring up The Grey, he's got dead wife syndrome in The Grey. People have a problem about using women as character motivation, particularly when they get killed or are dead. It's a thing. It's a trope. It's a trapping.
Mm.
It's a trope of the trappers. It's pure drama, right? It's pure character motivation.
Yes.
So that's why you always see it.
Well, Leo needs to be motivated by something.
But is it he's motivated? He's not motivated by the dead son is the motivation. The dead wife is to give him sadness.
Oh, that's right. To give him sadness and actually to give his death happiness.
So, yeah,
that's what it is, right? Same with the same in the in Inception. It's the kids that give him motivation. He wants to get back to the real world to be with them. It's actually the dead wife that kind of fucks that shit up and gets in the way. You know what I'm saying?
What is so wonderful about Inception is it's not so much the dead wife. It's him and it's his self-loathing.
Yeah,
and she's not. She's a figment. She's just brought to the wife is brought to life. The wife is brought to life by his mind.
Yeah, but talk about male gaze.
Talk about male gaze. She's dead, and
he's
giving her so much life. Is it a problem? Is it a problem?
No. Everyone's got a dead wife, right? In a film, or a dead kid, or a dead husband, or someone's got to be dead. You don't get a film these days without a dead in it. Because, you know, why not? Just go for it, man. Most people have got a dead. When you've got one, you go, oh, yeah, I understand that. Cool. In the mindset. Let's go.
Isn't it now just too... Do we not need to just go beyond that?
Are you saying it's clichéd to have a dead person?
Well, I think it is. It's a shorthand. It's become... Maybe twas ever thus.
I think it
was. Twas ever
was.
Thus a dramatic shorthand for someone have. I care about them because they've got a dead someone.
Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why. Okay, and I'm speaking now as someone with dead, and I'm speaking to someone with no dead. Okay, just a quick reminder for you and the audience. You don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, but do you want to see? Is that what you want to see? You want to see someone? You're like, oh, they've. So can you not connect with someone who's not got dead?
No. All I'm saying is there are things about grief that are obvious and are understood to be true by everyone generally, whether they have experienced it or not. There are other things that are slightly more subtle, but are a great tell. You know, particularly in a scenario like this where. Some of the audience will have gone through these experiences and some won't. One of them is that grief changes you. It has a hugely dramatic impact on you, right? And therefore, you can consider that death can be used as a motivation for a character's action. You can, or as an explanation as to why they behave in a certain way. You can also consider that grief is a precursor to enormous and sometimes radical change within a person's identity and behavior. And therefore, it would often be considered a more interesting time in someone's story or someone's life to make a film about. You know, interesting things tend to happen, you know, when people are grieving or when people have come out of grief, because in a sense they live in a completely different world than the one they did before. So I can see that there would be more ways of that mattering than it just being about motivation.
Yeah, and that's good. As someone who doesn't have any dead in their life. But then I just think then as a writer, isn't it just low hanging fruit?
Maybe, but like, what's wrong with that? Some of the times the low hanging fruit is delicious.
Because then would the deal, as someone who knows dead, what are some of the great films, or do you even have any that deal with grief? Are there any?
Yeah.
For the whole film and really get to the nub of it.
Yeah. There are two that come to mind. One's a TV episode, though.
That's so okay.
I'm going to break the rules.
Do you know what? I'm going to be a bigger man, and I'm going to let you say what that is.
I'm not going to spoil anything with this reference either, but there is an episode of the final season of Succession, which is dedicated to grief, and was, to me, an eerily accurate reflection of the experience in the immediate aftermath and the longer aftermath. And in a very nuanced way that I hadn't seen depicted on screen before. It's TV, so it has the benefit of dedicating the entire hour, episode, or however long it was, to that thing. And it's hard. It's much harder to do that in a film.
We will disregard. But so, can you think of a film that...
Yes, but here's the trick. No one's died. The film is Return to Seoul, which came out very recently.
I haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen it yet. I'm not going to spoil it for you. Don't worry. It is about a young woman who is French, but is adopted from Korea as a baby. And the beginning of the film shows her landing in Korea. And she speaks to her parents on the phone, and they weren't expecting her to go there. And she apparently wasn't expecting to go there. But there was a problem with her flight to Japan, so instead she went to Korea. And this is the beginning of the film. She doesn't go with the intention of trying to look for her family, but the film happens, right?
Great.
And whilst, strictly speaking, there's no grief, bereavement...
Oh, there is.
There is grief. There is grief.
And there is bereavement. Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's
an absolutely incredible look at that.
What's wonderful there that you've touched on, and what is so missing in when talks about conversations about grief, bereavement, it's conceptualized around a body, you know, a person, but then so often you know, one can grieve. I mean, this didn't happen to me, but but my wife, when we had our first child, she had a grief. She grieved for her former life, and because I didn't have to give birth, I didn't observe. There was a me in the past who didn't have kids. He's alive, and then my children were born, and then that guy died, and I'm someone else. But I didn't observe that, and I didn't grieve it, but my wife did. So she talked a lot about grief to me at that time, and I found that very interesting, because I'd only ever considered, you know, yeah, someone dies, and then you be like, yeah, you can die, a part of you, the life that you used to have, that can die, and then you have to observe that, and then you become someone else. So that sounds like what Return to Seoul speaks to. So I can't wait to see that.
You should watch it. And I will say also that I think that's the interesting thing about bereavement related grief, is that when somebody dies, you go through that initial period of shock and sadness. Then you go through a kind of longer period of, you know, you don't quite believe it, and you are reminded of it. But in the same way that you would go through any depression or illness or a tough time, you have this kind of notional idea that you'll come out of it at the other end, right? These are the sorts of language that is used in these sorts. At some point, you'll get back to normal, right? And that's true in most cases, but it's not true with bereavement, because when somebody dies, your life is changed forever. There is no going back to normal. There's going forwards to a new thing, and you are forced out of your control into accepting and eventually adopting the new life that you have, which is not the same as the one that you had before. There is no going back, right? And so that doesn't only happen when somebody dies. That isn't only related to a bereavement. That is also, it's death and babies. They're the two big ones, but there are loads of others that are part of that too. And that's where grief comes from. So in a sense, I agree with you. I do think it probably is slightly low-hanging fruit to always have a dead relative or spouse or child in the past in order to motivate a character. At the same time, though, The Revenant is already over 2.5 hours long. And I think if they had to pick something else for you to explain the character, the film would be 4 hours, and you would hate that too.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. Okay, let's play the box office game. It's going to be an interesting game this week for The Revenant.
For
the main reason that it will be interesting. The secondary reason is that they did something very unusual with their opening weekend, and we're going to get to that after you've guessed the budget, brackets estimated, for The Revenant. Now remember, they filmed on location. They didn't have a lighting budget because it was all natural light, but they could only film for an hour and a half a day.
Yeah, so they're filming for a long old time. They're paying everyone's wages.
Plus, that bear wasn't a real bear.
Oh, what? Really? It looked so real.
I know. And apparently there's some kind of pulley system that was in place to pull Leonardo DiCaprio around. And another one in his trailer to pull him off. But they both would have been very expensive.
It's a prestige picture.
Walk me through your thinking. It's a prestige picture.
It's a prestige picture, so they're going to spend more on this than they usually would have.
Yes.
And it's because they're not necessarily thinking. They're thinking we're not going to make our money back necessarily, unless we start getting the Oscar buzz.
Well, did they ever?
There's a punt. There's a punt involved, and they're going to overspend. They're going to go, well, you've got the Capricorns, we've got Inarritu.
Yeah. Hardy, of course. Mano y mano.
They would have spent... It's all up on screen. All those takes. So...
It's big budget, bro.
It's big budget. So let's say 80 mil.
Well, you are undercutting it, my guy. It is $135 million budget for this film.
I felt, as I was saying it, I felt like I was, but I was happy to undercut it.
Fine.
Because I think that's an obscene amount of money to spend on this fucking film. It's a complete, it just speaks to the ego. Again, the ego, fuck me.
Opening weekend. This is slightly unusual, Adam. Because the figure that's listed here, I'm going to tell you what it is and then I'm going to explain why, is $474,000, December 27th, 2015. Now, when I investigated further, I found that for the first 2 weeks of release, it was only available in 4 theatres. And then all of a sudden, on January the 8th in 2016... it was available in 3,375 theatres.
So let's go with that one.
Well, it ranked at on its actual official opening day, December 25th, Christmas Day, it ranked as 22nd in the world, despite only being available in 4 theatres. So that should tell you that it was a film people wanted to see. Now, for that opening weekend, Jan 8, 9, 10, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, have a guess.
Is it going to do 20 plus? That's what this kind of movie, that kind of budget. Let's say it made 25 mil.
It made $40 million.
Oh, Jesus.
Man.
Jesus.
You are underestimating Inarritu and Leo de Capricorn
in
this game.
I'm overestimating thickos and how pathetic they were. Let's go and see it. I really thought better of them, and they all just followed their snouts into the Oscar trough. Fucking pathetic.
Okay, fine. Right, now we're coming to the gross worldwide figure for The Revenant.
So it's costing 130. It's big Oscar. Everyone's jizzing over it. Gross worldwide, 480 million.
Can I tell you something?
Just tell me what.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
You're within 15%.
Well, that's,
you're not within 10%.
That's fine. That's fine.
$533 million this film made. Over half a bill.
So, and I'm close. I said 480.
You're really close, man. You're really close. I would also say that, and this is not to make you feel bad for your guess, this is to give you some idea of the power this film had. Its second weekend available in all those 3,000 theatres was at 30 million. Like, it just kept going and going.
Yeah, it's just really sad how everyone just, like, eats up their little gruel, thin gruel.
I kind of liked it. Thought it was all right.
When did length become a marker of quality?
When Lawrence of Arabia came out, my friend.
Okay, yeah, that's a good answer.
Pretty good answer.
But, I mean, I would say that you could shave an hour off Lawrence of Arabia.
I know you would say that. If you were there when Lawrence of Arabia came out and we were making this podcast, you'd watch that film and you'd go, it's ponderous. Nothing happens. These stars are so far up their own arses.
No, because I'm enjoying Arabia up to a certain point, and then there's like, then there's
which a bit? When they cross the big desert. But it's too far and it takes too long. You want them to be over there within 2 minutes because of movie magic.
Cinema Paradiso, I tell you what, that's a bit too long.
It's a corker though, isn't it?
Well, that goes on too long to remind audiences that Cinema Paradiso was my great shame. The film I'd not even forgot. I hadn't seen it.
Look, you've rectified that. Well done.
Once the kid grows up to a teenager... And then when he's an adult, it does go off the boil. I would say the actor who plays the grown-up version of Cinema Paradiso, he's not up to snuff. He's very blank and doesn't really do anything. But
did you like it when they cut all the kisses together, though?
Yeah, I would have liked it a lot more if they'd got a better actor in to play the grown-up version of Toto. But I think this is why I don't like Oscars and awards, because if a film's long, it equates to some sort of like heft and quality. Whereas I just disagree. I think the art is telling it a snappier story and like sticking with the genre. And I think that the people who made The Revenant should be all ashamed of themselves. They didn't know what to cut. They've got no sense of what a good story is, and they should hand the Oscar back.
Well, of course, we're speaking a few weeks after we've recorded our special Oscars episode.
Yeah.
We've released it. It hasn't happened in our timeline yet.
Don't promise something that we haven't done yet.
No, I like to do that because then it's extra funny when it doesn't happen.
Yeah, great, because everyone loves when we promise.
I found one of those,
stuff.
Actually. There's one of those in the episode I'm editing at the moment. Currently, I'm editing the episode The Thomas Crown Affair, which we recorded a long time ago, but is released in about a week. And
No, don't say that now, because it's not released within a week.
Isn't it? Oh, yeah.
Not when you say that.
Not when I say that, yeah, okay.
It's already on the feed,
it's
mate.
Gone out, yeah. There's three different timelines. There's the timeline where it was recorded a long time ago in this universe. There's the timeline when I'm editing it now and it's about to go out in a week in the universe I'm in. And then there's the one that the listeners are in, which is where it came out a long time ago, yeah. Those are the three different timelines, yeah. Anyway, within that, you say, oh, shall we watch, what's it called? The Hilary Swank and Gerard Butler film. The rom-com.
Oh, P.S. I Love You.
P.S. You said, shall we watch P.S. I Love You for next week's episode as an adjunct? And I said, yeah, you'll have to remind me. I said, yes, I hope we remember. And you said, I'll be remembering. And you made a big point about how you'd be remembering that. And then I think we both completely forgot and never watched it and never talked about it again.
Can we, though? Because...
Sure, if we can remember.
G Should we do the game where I read out a list of... Well, one of us reads out a list of films they'd forgot to catch the other guy out.
I quite like that, yes. And it's your turn this week, isn't it?
Hail Caesar.
No.
Planet of the Apes.
Which one?
The remake, the Tim Burton.
Nah, we talked about that recently. I veto.
Yeah, it's a shame you veto that.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Man on Fire?
Is that with Denzel?
Yeah.
Do you know, amusingly, I rewatched that for the first time in 15 years within the last year. And as I was doing it, I thought, I should have saved this because this is the perfect movies you forgot. But as it is, I didn't forget it.
There are some here I really don't want to do, but I know I'm going to get you on.
Oh, no.
So I've got to... I think things you'll want to do them.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Jarhead.
Is it a return to Mendes? Do you want a Mendes nuts all over again? Is that it?
I mean, I don't want to. It does make it look like we've run out of ideas.
Do you know what, though?
It's Jake Gyllenhaal.
It's Jake Gyllenhaal.
It's a war film.
It's quite interesting. Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah, I remember really liking it, but never, ever, ever having any interest in watching it ever again.
And I think if you're anything like me, you will... It's one of those ones where I remember that it is a film, but I remember nothing about the film.
Yeah, likewise. And I think it's also... I don't want to be crass, but... It's not in the canon, but it's orbiting the canon. It's the kind of thing that would flop on telly and be on a streaming service, and people would click on it.
It's kind of canon because it's about a war that there weren't like a million films made about, maybe five that people know.
Have we done any modern war films? Iraq?
No, we've talked about a couple. We talked about the Matt Damon one, and we talked about the Leo DiCaprio one, which is Body of Lies, and then Green Zone is the Matt Damon one, right? They've popped up in conversation.
And I always mention Three Kings.
You always mention Three Kings, but I haven't seen that.
That's okay.
So I don't think we have done modern war, unless you count Dune.
We've done lots of Mendes, though.
We did King Arthur, which, again, to some, they might consider that modern.
My only memory of Jarhead is it is about the moments in between, the boredom of war.
Yeah.
And that's what I liked about it. Great, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to be doing Jarhead.
We're going to watch Jarhead, and then we're probably going to spend the whole time talking about The Hurt Locker, right?
That's a movie I forgot.
Is it actually?
Yeah.
The Hurt Locker?
Yeah.
The Hurt Locker is a movie you forgot.
Absolutely.
Are you doing a joke?
No joke. You know, that's just a very forgettable, overrated film in my memory. I'm not saying it is. In my memory, I look in the filing cabinet. The filing cabinet it's in is forgettable, overrated.
Listen, okay, here's a quick...
I'll watch both.
Would you watch both?
I'm pretty sure it's on...
Could we do both?
It was on BBC iPlayer. Well, let's not name the episode, but...
Why not? What if we're spreading out here, we're changing things up. What if we were to say Jarhead and The Hurt Locker?
Yeah, okay.
Do you wanna?
Great, well, so that was the Revenant episode. We'll be doing a surprise double next, Jarhead and The Hurt Locker. And yeah, we'll see you next week. Say bye.
Bye.